Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode number 62 of Material Issues. This is going to be a good one. I'm Mark Hirschberger of Pop Detective Records, and joining me, as he does every Wednesday for over the last year, the president of the International Pop Overthrow Festival, my good friend from the West Coast, Mr. David Bash. David, how are you feeling tonight, my friend?
I'm feeling great, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, everything's been working out this week with a number of strangely left of center things.
Everything's coming up profits.
Everything's coming up profits. I wouldn't that be nice?
Not financial profits, but spiritual ones. Chez doing so much better now. I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah, there's a lot of good things. You know, life throws you curveballs. You just gotta adjust from hitting the fastball to the curveball and making it work. But it's all good. It's all good. I'm really glad to be here tonight. We've got a great guest. People are going to find out about that in a couple minutes. What do you got going on in the international pop overthrow world? Coming up is...
Well, first I have to announce that after putting on this orange paisley shirt, I had to dig out my Seiko... I can't even do it. I'm taking it off here for a second so I can show it. It's my Seiko Divers Turtle Watch, which is
orange,
light orange, and has some blue trim. And it's the Japanese model, so it has the kanja characters and the English characters for the day of the week. I don't know if you can see that in here.
A little bit.
It's pretty cool. This is definitely among my... certainly in my top 10 in my collection.
If you are anything, my friend, you are fashionable.
I do my best.
You really are.
Thank you. As far as IPO goes, we finished IPO LA on Saturday. I remember last week, I believe, when we spoke, I was lamenting the very light crowds, but they fortunately got better. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night were well attended. But more important than that, the bands were tremendous this year. I mean, they're always really good, but I think from top to bottom this year, they were all solid and some really great. So I was very, very pleased with the performances. And anybody who's watching that did play IPOLA, I want to thank you so much for playing. You really made my week. And Rena's, and you know, the people who did come, they were all impressed.
And the IPO CD, the three disc set, made it in time. And
fantastic. I now have some tracks up on the IPO site. If you have, I put some tracks on the IPO site on the homepage, but I found out subsequently that because I put waves up for the first year, they allowed the space for me to do that now. Apple devices won't play them. So you can watch them on any desktop or laptop. Well, not an Apple laptop, but you know, if you have an Android phone, you'll be able to watch them. But iPhones and iPads, I say watch them, listen to them. But not yet. I have to go in and make MP3s. I don't. You know what? I used to know how to do them on iTunes. They've changed something now, and I don't know how anymore. I've been trying to look it up. It's not
to be 50 again.
yeah, no doubt. Well, yeah, the mind is certainly gone. And also the technology is, it's superseding my capacity here. But so the CDs are now available to pre-order on the Omnivore Recordings website. So just go to Omnivore. You'll see on the homepage upcoming releases. You'll see it. You'll see the a picture of the cover. Just click on that and you'll be able to pre-order it. Coming out in early September. Of course, those who attended IPOLA, at least from Monday on, were able to get copies. So if you've heard it already, let me know what you think. I'm incredibly impressed with it. Yeah. Of course, Mark, I'm going to be sending a whole bunch of them out next week to the artists who are on it, and you will get a copy, and so will some of the writers who requested promo copies will get one as well. So, yeah, so that's all good. And San Francisco comes up on from August 18th through 20th at a venue we'd used for many years, Hotel Utah. So we're looking forward to to getting back there. But, you know, we could talk about IPO forever, which is my license plate, IPO 4 EVR. But we've got a guest this week, and a very esteemed guest, Emmy-nominated writer for David Letterman. He wrote for Letterman for 19 years. That's pretty amazing. He's written an episode for The Simpsons. He's written songs for different projects. He's written sitcom projects. He's still doing, or lately, I should say, has been doing a lot of short films. And he's probably best known for being in the documentary, the award-winning documentary, Bathtubs Over Broadway, which both of us have seen and love. And we're going to highly recommend to everyone watching that they see it too. Just an all-around Renaissance man and a very good guy. We're glad to have him. Would you please give a huge Material Issues welcome to Mr. Steve Young?
And there he is. And
there he is with a new shirt. Oh, I'm loving it.
So when we checked in right before you guys went on the air, I realized I had to up my shirt game.
You have.
I just had a boring t-shirt on it. I can do a little better for these guys. So, Mark and David, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for the lovely intro. Shockingly, it was actually 25 years at the Letterman Show, if you come out.
I think we were.
Yes, it says on your website 19, so somebody has some updating to do.
All right, we'll work on that.
It's all right. It's a very long time.
My bad. It says 19 Emmy nominations.
I want to dig down too deep there, but that's probably it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Steve. This is an absolute thrill, as you know, not only David and I, as collectors, as you can see in his back wall as well, but and lovers of music. And sometimes the cool but strange music and things, to learn about industrial music the years ago when that book came out, and find a genre that I never even knew existed is amazing. And the fact that you got involved with it is also amazing. So we're going to catch up with that.
Please explain to the people watching what industrial music is, because record people, who are most of our audience, they'll think of it as like, you know, rock music like Throbbing Gristle and bands like
Throbbing
that.
Gristle's
that
always
is not what you're about.
No, my gristle is extremely serene. the thing about this genre is it's unique or close to it, because almost any other kind of music you can think of, any record album or CD you can think of, was intended to be out for sale to the public. And people who made it wanted it to go as widely into the world as it could through whatever luck and promotion and talent. Industrial musicals or industrial shows were kind of the hidden secret shadow world of the entertainment business for a long time. They're basically Broadway style musicals that were created for company conventions and sales meetings, like Xerox or Ford Tractor or Coca-Cola, and they were performed behind closed doors at these company functions. If you were a civilian walking down the street in Las Vegas or whatever, and you saw "Welcome RCA Distributors" on a marquee, you might think, "What's that?" And you went up to the box office. You could not go in if you were not an RCA distributor there for the big meeting. But inside, there was basically a Broadway show all about your company and the work you do and the new product line and the new marketing plans and why it was going to be a great year and why you could believe in what you did for the company, because it was not just to make money. It was to live a better life and make humanity better. It could get quite ambitious in its scope. But I started finding the souvenir record albums from these things trickling into thrift shops and used record stores when I was doing the Dave's record collection bit on the Letterman show back in the day. I had to find anything we could make fun of on the show that would be a real unintentionally funny record we could play and Dave would have a quip. And I started finding crazy records. I could not believe something like this existed. Detroit diesel engine division of General Motors had a musical about the selling and servicing of diesel engines. Well, that's already a home run comedically, just because of the concept of it. Things like My Insurance Man, a whole musical about selling insurance.
Now, initially, when you looked for those records for Dave, he wanted them more because the cover themselves just seemed absurd, seemed funny. But at the time, nobody really knew what they were about until you started playing them, right?
Yeah, I mean, I only had 2, 3, 4. I didn't realize for a while that this seems to be the tip of a genre, and how big it widens out to, I don't know. But, I mean, just comedically, you're already kind of a 3/4 of the way there for purposes of the Letterman show bit. If you hold up, oh, it's the JCPenney musical. Just, okay, well, that's absurd that there is something. But what got me, after I had, I don't know, 6 or 7 or so of these things, I realized, okay, the bit is over. It was 2 weeks ago, and I'm still singing the diesel engine songs or the JCPenney songs or the insurance sales songs. I thought, this is not right somehow. This is way better than it should have been, because I thought it was just a cheesy joke, but I just thought, this is kind of great, I think. How well, many you know, are there? Can I find more? Could I find 10? Could I find 20? Well, now I've got like 200.
Amazing. Wow. And if people are joining in early here and they're wondering what this may sound like, I've got some clips here. We were just talking about let me get this thing up here. Second. I got a nice little diesel dazzle. So there's the album cover, right?
Yeah.
And this is a little clip of Diesel Dazzle. That's just awesome. So if anybody's wondering what we're talking about, that's what we're talking about.
Yes.
And the first, and as I'm watching Bathtubs Over Broadway, which is the documentary that features these industrial musical records, the thing that I'm wondering, and ultimately the question gets answered, the thing I'm wondering is why? Why are these companies spending so much money to do a behind the scenes musical? And you had mentioned how much they cost. They cost even more than My Fair Lady at the time. And now I know the answer, but can you tell everybody why these companies felt it was necessary to do this?
I think by the 1950s, there was a sense that, all right, corporate America is doing well, but people inside the machinery of it may not feel that it's a mission that speaks to their soul. And by this time, musicals like Oklahoma, South Pacific, they had become huge mainstream popular entertainments. Mm-hmm. And some visionary people by the mid-50s realized, if we took this form and adapted it for our own messaging, and Oldsmobile or whoever did not invent this. There were actually some union musicals as far back as the 30s. About like the International Ladies Garment Worker Union, like we must all stand together, things like that. But this was the flip side of the company saying, we will do better, all of us, individually and collectively, if people are excited to work here and believe in the mission and think, not only am I going to make money, but this is going to be good for America.
Yeah.
And it took off in the 50s. Suddenly it was every car company, GE appliances, Coke, Pepsi, Westinghouse, everything down to the smallest, like floor tile companies and all that. Just
yeah, even as is in your book, you see some companies that you don't even know what they make.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, well, I don't even know what this company does, but they're singing about silicon. You know,
yeah, that was General Electric, so that was big. And you have like the disposable paper hospital gown company. They did two musicals. They were like, we gotta jump on this. It was I think there was a bit of an arms race feeling, like, oh, Plymouth just had 40 people asked, we better come back over at Chevrolet next year and show them we're in the top spot in this town in terms of musicals and Mars musicals. Yeah, it was a prestige thing for quite a while.
We had a question come in from Denver, and I think you kind of answered already, but Brian says, Bathtubs of Bravery, wonderful. Big Letterman fan, especially the NBC years. Did you contribute to those great bits like Day's record collection? I think, you know, we've kind of answered that, yeah.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is, on the very first day in 1990, when I joined the staff at the NBC show, the head writer, Steve O'Donnell, brought me down the hall in 30 Rock on the 14th floor and said, well, we're going to get you an office. Several writers had left, went to greener pastures in LA and the sitcom world. There were several offices. He said, how about this one? And I said, fine, what are all these record albums here? There were boxes of records. And he said, oh, the writer who was in this office used to do a bit called Dave's Record Collection. Hey, maybe you can be the new Dave's Record Collection guy. So within the first 20 minutes of my arriving at the show, the ball started rolling. it's still rolling, but it's just an enormous, long, crazy journey that's been wonderful. And it's caused me to be here with you guys. So
were you a record collector prior to doing this?
No, I had, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I had vinyl because that's all you had for a while. I had the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Doors and the Beach Boys. But around 92, when I moved to New York, I thought, okay, this is all junk now. I got to get rid of all this vinyl, and sold it off real cheap at a store downtown. And I don't really regret that. My record collection is very small by the standards of many serious record collectors, but it's incredibly deep in the world's narrowest category.
You
can't get this stuff in any other form except for the compilations that I've been involved in now, because this was the most ephemeral thing ever. If they pressed a record, it was a miracle, because nobody really thought by 6 months after the diesel engine convention that somebody was really going to revisit the glories of the sales meeting there. But so it was very rare to get a record pressed. And then most of them were probably thrown away quickly enough. Some of the records I have in my collection are the single known copy in the world of something.
Now, there's a question for you, Steve, while we're still there, because I want to take you back a little further. But when you say getting a record pressed, I wonder if there are records from the record pressing houses in the 60s and 70s that would actually tell you if there were records ordered by corporations.
I think that is a great future avenue of investigation, because some of these were custom pressed.
Yeah.
RCA or Columbia, just like, all right, we'll handle this for you, Ford truck or Pepsi or whoever. They were not released, obviously, on these labels, but they big companies would do the pressing, and there'd right. be a matrix number. And some people are probably advanced enough to have, I don't know if ledgers exist where you could go looking through and find out shows no one's ever heard of. That would be fun. Give me things to agonize over looking for. That's all I need. But there are realms of detective work yet to be done here. What's interesting is, almost none of the corporations themselves saved any of this. They thought this was junk weeks later. And even like Ford or Coca-Cola, GE, companies that are huge then and now, very little of it has emerged from their archives. Their Ford Motor Company is going, we did what? You're kidding. Yeah, I got the records to prove it.
Well, you know, think about it. If they pressed ashtrays with their logo on it instead of the vinyl, people would use ashtrays. Cigarette smoking kind of fell out of favor. You junk the ashtray when they were given the vinyl, and then vinyl kind of fell out of favor when CDs came along and whatnot. A lot like you did, a lot of people got rid of their vinyl, and these were even rare to begin with, and that makes it even rarer.
Yeah, you find some that clearly after Dad got home from the convention, looked at the Keds sneaker sales convention record and go, and give it to their 5-year-old. Here, you want to start a record? And so sometimes like gouged with crayon all over them because I got a record. It just was not valued. And why would it be, really? I mean, sometimes there's a letter saying, we encourage you to listen to this at home with your family to relive all the excitement. I can't imagine many people did that.
Well, I can say this, Steve. Oh, to be a fly on the wall in that BF Goodrich sales meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear it. Hey, Norm, I reported $1,200 in commission sales, but I only sold 1,000. Or and you know those tires I sold to the Green family? I put little holes in them and wait till they run out of air. Until those musicals, though, and then they probably decided to work a lot harder.
Yeah, I don't want to over-glamorize corporate cheerleading spirit. I don't want to be an apologist for Exxon or whoever. These companies were full of the same range of humanity that anything is now, just like good people, medium people, horrible people who would make horrible decisions. But I do think there was a time post-war America for a few decades, companies felt like they could in general afford to care about the people who worked for them.
Yeah. Yes.
Wanted them to feel loyal and wanted to earn the loyalty by proving we got your back. When there's problems, we're going to help you take care of it. Some of these shows are like lessons in management consulting. There are songs about something that everybody in the audience was pissed off about, and the company would be brave enough to say, you know what, put that in the show. People will be so gratified to learn that we're admitting the problems. It was a very smart way to reach out to disaffected people in your company about a problem and say, our bad, we know it. We're going to treat it humorously in a song, and then we're going to do our damnedest to fix it. And it could have a huge effect on the company morale. So that started to go away in the 70s, I think, from what people have told me. Consultants and accountants came in and said, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if people are happy. We don't care if they like to work here.
Right.
Not in the bottom line. Just get rid of all the stuff about morale building and teamwork. And then things kind of went to crap for quite a while. And we're still trying to dig ourselves out of some of that.
Well, we got a question that popped in. Get to Andy's question because it's something that some of these people don't know. It came in from the UK. But Andy says, were these proper staged musicals or were they just recorded for the records?
Most were real stage shows. I mean, you get pictures on the back of these things sometimes showing, oh, yeah. And like Diesel Dazzle, I have the program that says, oh, there were 4 or 5 performances in April of 1966 in Detroit. But the inside gatefold's got all the pictures of the show also. So, yeah, the stagecraft of this stuff was absolutely Broadway level. They had the money to throw gobs of production value onto this stuff. Florence Henderson, who I interview in Bathtubs Over Broadway, when she was starting out, she did Oldsmobile dealer shows, full musicals. And she said, I would put those Oldsmobile shows up against anything that was actually on Broadway at the time. The talent, top to bottom, A+, just the first Oldsmobile show would be in New York at a real Broadway theater. Everyone from New York's theater world came because they thought, well, it's crazy because it's a musical about Oldsmobiles, but it is going to be actually kind of great. So people in this world knew that at the top level of this stuff, there was nothing to sneer at. It may be bizarre conceptually, but everybody was somebody you might work with someday at the top of the field on Broadway.
And of course, if people check out Bathtubs Over Broadway, or if they go to your website and they check out all the clips and things of the music is fantastic. Just, you know, change the lyrics to something like, you know, Oklahoma or South Pacific or whatever, and you've got incredible music. It's just that the lyrics take you in a whole different direction.
And that's something I wanted to ask you about, Steve. You know, some of these musicals did parody songs of, you know, major Broadway songs or pop songs or whatever. And I saw you singing one of them in Bathtubs Over Broadway. When you sing one of those songs, can you help? I know this is an arcane question, but can you help hearing the original lyrics in your head? Because I know I can't.
Well, number one, we're here for arcane questions. That's kind of the theme of the day. But I've learned so much backwards about musical theater. I grew up knowing nothing about it. It was all, like I said, Beatles, Led Zeppelin, all that. There was no My Fair Lady or Hello, Dolly in my house. So I was hearing parodies on these industrial show records that I didn't know were parodies. I just thought, oh, this is a great song in this Chrysler Plymouth show. Something everyone in Plymouth 65. And I thought, oh, that's good. It turns out, oh, that's from a funny thing happened on the way to the forum. I found out 10 years later. So I'm still finding out, but I learn it all backwards. Like I, some stuff I do know, like I have an Armor Pork sales meeting record where they took Winchester Cathedral because it was hot right then,
yeah,
66, and they made it all about pork products. I can't sing the real Winchester Cathedral song, but I can sing the pork. I know that backwards and forwards.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Here's another clip, and I'll never be able to sing this song correctly the rest of my life. Here you go.
To dream the impossible dream, to increase sales by 20%, to check stock and to fill in the staples, to make sure sports shirts keep getting sold.
That's just awesome.
Was this another one you didn't know at the time?
That
the original?
Pervasive enough in the culture I knew growing up that, yeah, I knew that one. I have some grounding in reality, but that, yeah, the parodies can be charming and hilarious, and I do love the crazier ones just because they're so wrong. And sometimes they're just awkward and feel sweaty and rushed. But what really, I mean, that would be fun to collect if that's all this genre was. But when I got to the original music and lyric stuff, like Diesel Dazzle, My Insurance Man, and of course, you can't talk about this genre without this one.
Now we're gonna play that clip here shortly. That's David and I were discussing this pre-show before you came on. It was just
I have an idea for Steve. I don't know if he's gonna like it, but I'm gonna have to say it anyway.
I'm gonna claim to like it.
All right. Go.
All right. Well, since we're here, let's put this up real quick. Here's the album Steve was talking about. It's called The Bathrooms Are Coming.
American Standard, 1969 musical for plumbing fixture distributor.
And here is the clip. This is My Bathroom.
My bathroom, my bathroom is a private kind of place. Very special kind of place. My
bathroom.
I call that song the gateway drug. If you play a song for people, whatever preconceived notions about how embarrassingly chintzy and cheesy this genre must be, that it's kind of rocks them back on their heels. Like, that's like a legitimate good song. And it's bathrooms. And it rewires your brain to think, well, if that can be true about a song about bathrooms, maybe it's true about songs about selling tractors and light bulbs and Pepsi Cola and anything else you think. And I will emphasize, not all of this stuff is great. There's a bell curve, like with anything else. There's the hilariously awful far end of the curve. There's a big, broad middle that's really pretty good. And then there's the shocking upper level that, oh my God, what? How did it? Geniuses were just throwing this stuff around. And I loved talking to the people that wrote these things. And you see me talking to some of them in bathtubs over Broadway. And I loved hearing from these people. And any creative person, I think, struggles with this. How do you reconcile? I might do the best work of my life that will be heard by 195 people once and then never again. And do you feel okay about that?
Yeah.
Yes, people got good paychecks to do this stuff, but
I saw the clip where you're playing the guitar for the woman that sang this song. What was her name?
The woman who sang My Bathroom is named Pat Stanton Janola. It took me a long time to track her down. I've been trying for years to find various cast members and the composer of that song. If you see Bathtubs, you'll see finally there was a breakthrough. And she was, like all these people, utterly amazed that nearly 50 years later, someone had popped up to say, that thing that you did and forgot about, probably thought no one would ever ask you about, and you put it out. No, we're going to talk about it, and we're going to talk about why it's great, and I'm interested in your life and your approach to your work and all that. This could not have been less expected by any of these people. But yes, I was on stage with her playing a guitar, arranged a great song, and she sang it in front of a big theater full of people, and it kind of it blows your mind. I mean,
what an emotional moment. I mean, you could tell for her it was a very big deal. I could tell for you it was a very big deal. The emotions just popping off that stage were, and in many scenes where you're talking to composers and whatnot, just, you know, it really goes deep. And as you said, something that they kind of threw away in their mind and forgot about, that nobody would ever care about at any point, and all of a sudden it was all that. And,
yeah. Hank Beebe with Diesel Dazzle. Hank's 96 now. I talked to him on his birthday about a week ago.
Oh, wow.
Still happy super birthday, Hank. Great friend and mentor and wonderful presence in my life. And just, I've learned from them so much about how to approach doing creative work in a tough world that doesn't give a shit about it. Your feelings or your artistry or whatever. Just, it's all right, what can you do for me? How can I make money? There are artists and people with real higher beliefs in these companies. Hank Beebe told me about the Diesel Dazzle, the diesel engine vice president, who was a cut above any other executive he'd ever known, and said, just go out and do a great show. Here's the messaging we got to put in it. But if you have to put in stuff that's going to make us look bad, for the bigger purpose of, yes, we know there are problems, do it. It's going to be hard, but we want you to do it. Not many companies were that brave, but that guy was.
Sure. All right, Steve, I have to bring up this idea because I'm going to burst if I don't. But first, well, the thing I want to say first is Sid Siegel was lucky that Brian Wilson didn't sue him for In My Bathroom, because it's reminiscent of the Beach Boys' In My Room. Subject matter, the whole thing. But here's my idea. Steve, you need to either do or have somebody you know do the first pornographic industrial musical. And Bathrooms Are Coming can write itself. First of all, you change the spelling of coming. I don't have graphic than that. And she's talking in the song about the bathroom is where I cream. Now, of course, I know back then cream meant put your face cream on, but it means something different now. And then finally, you've got the scene with the sink that hasn't quite been finished yet.
Oh, the water spray. Yeah.
So there you go. It writes itself, Steve.
On that topic, I will say you've tapped into something that I've occasionally thought about. Like, yeah, the bathroom song has where I cream and dream, and that always gets a roar of laughter from a modern audience.
Yes.
Asked Sid Siegel. Sid, was this meant to be kind of a, you know, a little winking joke? He said, no.
Back then it didn't.
I don't know if I believe him. I mean, some of these people put crazy stuff in these shows and wanted to have plausible deniability, but I think among the ways they wanted to do a good job was to have little secret stuff to amuse themselves. Like if you saw Bathtubs, there was a film, a 1967 Purina Dog Chow musical. And I love that crazy movie so much. Yes, I have films now in addition to the records, but it's all lip synced. There were musical performances that were dubbed in over the actors. And sometimes the voices switch between actors, which is either sloppy and lazy or a genius level conceptual joke. And I don't know.
Well, you talked a lot about, I love the way you put this. You talked a lot about the sweet spot between what's supposed to be great and what's supposed to be awful. Right. You know, like there are a lot of like the movie, the 70s teen movie, Bad Ronald. It's a cult. It's a cult classic now because it's so bad, it's good. And that's one of those sweet spot ones that you're talking about. I love that phrase. I'm going to borrow it every time I try to convey that. Yeah,
that moment when I spoiler alert, I, after years of detective work, locate film footage of the Bathrooms Are Coming show, and I watch it. And the music, I still maintain, is at a shockingly high level of crap. Yeah. Quality and production. The film is kind of a shambling mess. So I can't tell anymore. Is this the best thing ever or the worst thing ever? That's kind of a great place to be.
Yeah. Those are great. Yeah, I love that.
It's compelling. It's just all my references for quality or value have to be recalibrated because nothing makes sense in this universe now.
Let's rewind a second, Steve. Where are you from? Where did you grow up before you moved into New York?
I grew up in semi-rural Massachusetts, about an hour outside of Boston. Just sort of pretty much normal suburban kid in the 70s and 80s. You know, played Little League baseball and built some model airplanes and had no notion that odd kinds of music or cultural debris might be in my future. Although I think I did have early warning signs of a weird sense of humor. I was kind of the funny kid in class sometimes. I was not disruptive. I was a good boy, but I could say bizarre things without thinking too hard about it. And ended up at Harvard back when just nice, normal people could have a shot at getting in. Grew up in Massachusetts, and when I got the application for Harvard, I was stunned to find out that Harvard was in my home state. I had never really known where it was. You can't be that naive anymore, but you could in the early 80s. But when I was there, I got on the humor magazine, the Harvard Lampoon, and That was kind of a big turning point.
Was Doug Kenny a big hero of everybody on the Lampoon?
Doug Kenny, a legend because he had gone off and not sold out by becoming a corporate lawyer or whatever. He said, I want to keep being a comedy badass even when I'm graduated, and one of the founders of National Lampoon. But the person in front of me then in the mid-80s was Conan O'Brien. He was the president.
Oh, wow.
Of the magazine there, and I thought, this guy is something. This is the first time I'd seen somebody with that extra level X factor of just, he's funny. He walks in a room. If I said what he said, it wouldn't work as well because he's funny. How can I be more like that? So whatever spark I've had, I've tried to cultivate, but it was my first realization. Some people are just funny, and it's exciting to see where they'll go. I would like to try to do my own version of that. So after college, I kicked around for a while. I was a bartender in Boston trying to write stuff. I worked a little bit in California, but I joined the Letterman staff in early 1990.
Wow.
How did you, what was it about you that Letterman found, yeah, we need to have this guy?
The problem for finding writers for that show, and probably any show, always is, we need somebody who gets our core sensibility, but won't just replicate what we already have from everybody else. We need somebody whose voice shades into a different direction, kicks open the window of possibility a little somehow. And that's a very tricky thing. Dave saw a lot of material and shrugged at it. Your batting average was never going to be that good, but we wanted people who could try something that no one else was going to think of. And I guess the head writer, Steve O'Donnell, who hired me, thought, we're not sure, hard to tell when someone's green, but maybe this guy will have a little bit of a twist that Dave hasn't seen before. And on a good day, yes, myself and the rest of the writers would have something that Dave kind of went, huh, you know, I've been around for a long time, seen a lot of stuff. I've never thought about something like that before. That's the gold standard when you showed Dave something that really kind of made him go, wow, let me see that again.
Is he easy to work with?
What's that?
Was Dave easy to work with?
He was very demanding, and he had the highest standards for himself. He was never satisfied with his own performance on anything. You wished he could relax a little bit, but I wouldn't say it was easy there. You could get to understand how to ride the job so that the hardness of it was just, you're used to it. But if it was easy, then it wasn't right, probably, because your first take idea rarely is the one that we would think was good enough.
And that's, that's an ode to your talent in general and the way you look at the world and see things. It's gotta come from a different perspective, which you seem to have. I mean, I love that one picture on your site that talks about the Wright brothers' little known invention when it points to the bench.
Oh yeah,
there's the plane. Oh.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the bench and you're like, yeah, that's just a different way of looking at even a picture. And and even with your photography, it's a different way of looking at things, which I think, you know, not everybody has that, you know, and some people can struggle to find that. But if you have to struggle to find it, then it's really not there. You know,
you don't get true inspiration all the time. My friend Hank told me a quote. A professional is somebody whose best work is outstanding and whose worst work is acceptable. So on a bad day, I wanted to be at least acceptable. Maybe tomorrow the true inspiration would come. But yeah, I did very well as a sort of career strategy by having a knack for a million people are looking at the same photo. What's the detail no one's thinking about that I can develop into an idea?
I loved it. And I just real, you know, quick, speak about some of your photography. Here's a couple of my favorite I pulled from your website. I love this. I love the ambulance showing up with a pumpkin. Yeah. That's obviously too late. It's too late. This is one of my favorites as well, where you have the visitor guide matching up to the actual painting on the wall.
Oh, just a
great way of looking at things. And then my all-time favorite, this one right here. I want a poster that to put that on my wall.
The next scene of that should have been the bird upside down. So you're flipping the bird. I miss my calling as a comedy writer.
You're about ideas here, David.
Well, actually, when I was at NYU, I was a journalism student, and I did, my specialty was captioning pictures.
Oh, yeah.
I did that more for fun than I didn't end up pursuing journalism as a career, but I enjoyed it.
When you walk around, Steve, do you carry a camera or do you use your phone? That's a question I was wondering about.
I have an iPhone 7 that's always on me. Sometimes if I think, all right, I'm going to be out for the day and I'm going to an interesting new neighborhood, I'll bring my more serious camera, which is still, it fits in my pocket. It makes a big lump in my pocket. And I try to, if I'm going somewhere I think there's good potential, I'll try to bring the better camera. Although if I someday replace my 5-year-old iPhone, I might spring for the one with the super good camera in it.
Well, they're saying in 5 years, you know, these cell phones and their lenses are going to make all cameras obsolete. They're going to be so good.
The short films that I've been doing that I wrote and acted in, the Bathtubs Over Broadway filmmaker, the director, Dava Huizenant, she made these films, the short films. She shot and edited them, but she shot those on an iPhone 11 Pro. So you can do pretty well. And we've had a nice response on the film festival circuit. Good stuff fits in your pocket these days.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Do you enjoy acting as much as you did comedy writing and all the other things you've done?
It is seductive, I will say. Being in the documentary, you're not acting. You're just trying to be an unselfconscious version of yourself going about your business and having a real, like, it's not scripted what I say to anybody. I might know certain questions that I should get to if I'm interviewing Florence Henderson or Cheetah Rivera, but that, not really acting, but it did make me probably feel more comfortable on camera. And I had done some little bits on the Letterman show here and there, but those two short films we made in New Mexico, partly for budget reasons, but also I just think, no, I know what these should be like. So I acted in them. I'm very confident that Dava and I will have a good result. So yeah, I had the bug bit me a little bit. I was at a film festival last summer where we showed them, and I was chatting with other filmmakers afterwards, and this guy emailed me later and said, hey, would you like to have a role in this indie feature we're doing? Yeah, I think you'd be good. We need a guy like you to, so suddenly I was acting in an actual movie.
At what point, because the book came out in 2013, correct? 2013. Yep. And this is the book we're talking about, in case anybody has not figured it out yet. It's called Everything's Coming Up Prophets, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, Steve Young and Sport Murphy, your co-writer, also a musician.
Did his parents name him Sport? Or
I think he adopted that himself as
adolescent.
But yeah, Sport's a very smart guy and very talented writer, artist, and musician. And turned out we didn't know it at first, but we were competing on eBay for these records. And the origin story is he decided to find out who it was that kept it outbidding him and tracking him down. And then we realized we had a lot to talk about. And
at what point did you think, like, I've got enough of a collection of this kind of material, or with him or with some of the other people that were in the documentary, that you could put together such a wonderful, I call it almost a coffee table book, because it's a big book. It's a wonderful book. And where did the genesis of that idea even come from?
I'd been thinking for a while, because my collection was getting pretty big. I had a lot of primo stuff. I thought we ought to put out a couple discs worth of greatest hits on CD. And I actually approached various indie record labels that I thought were cool and funky. And the first question always was, well, who owns the rights to these tracks? Yep. I would say, that's a very good question, and I generally don't know the answer. Some of this stuff was copyrighted. Some of it wasn't. Some of it lapsed. Some of it was owned by the composers. Some of it was owned by the production companies. It was quite a labyrinth. And so I realized I don't know if I have the bandwidth to spend the next 5 years of my life in investigating the legal status of these things. So I set that aside. But then Sport, a few years later, said, you know, I know some people who have a very cool publishing imprint, and they do little known cultural histories and forgotten histories and things like that. They might like this. And we went down there and, yes, a book will be the way to do it. And then we did put some tracks on the website, industrialmusicals.com. But then through there, you can also go to other compilations I've put out, which give you a pretty good overview, best of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. There's also a Bathtubs Over Broadway soundtrack, which is something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, the vinyl soundtrack, wonderful.
One other thing I'm sure you're proud of, and this is the most poignant moment to me of Bathtubs Over Broadway, near the end, where you're kind of reflecting on what you've done, where you're taking stock of the fact that, for example, people 50 years later who never would have thought that anyone would remember them are now being brought back to life by you and the people who now collect these records and everything that this documentary had accomplished. And you start getting tears in your eyes and your voice starts quavering. And I can relate to it to some degree. I run a music festival called International Pop Overthrow. We showcase pop bands, melodic rock and roll bands from all around the world. I mean, we're not at the level that you are, but sometimes I sit back and I realize that, you know, I've changed people's lives. I've given people up, like, to play at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. I'm very modest, but I mean, I also realize that, yeah, I have done some things for people. And I sit back and I get kind of chills, the same way you did. You didn't know that was going to come upon you when you said those words, did you? It just sort of hit you.
The long arc of this was just, I got to get material to make fun of on the Letterman show. And then, this is interesting, what else can I find out about it? Fast forward all these years later, where I'm meeting these people who I realize they have a lot to teach me about how to approach life and human connections and art and how we come to mean something to ourselves or to each other. And it became a mission to me that I want the world to understand what I saw, that you, first there's the level, this is crazy and bizarre and hilarious, and then underneath it are all these life lessons about people deciding I'm going to do great work, even if I won't ever really be able to explain it to very many people. These composers and performers, sometimes their families could not even quite grasp how to tell anybody and their friends, what does dad do? Well, he writes, you mean commercials? No, not exactly. It's like a show. How can that, that makes no sense. Now these families just say, watch Bathtubs Over Broadway. That'll explain it. So it's a great load off these people's minds sometimes that finally my professional existence, the story of it has been gathered up and elegantly presented, and I don't have to feel like a weird asterisk off to the side of humanity anymore.
Well, and that's really kind of made a lot of people happy. And, you know, not in the usual entertainment way where it's just pure entertainment. You've taken people who felt forgotten and who did something very important, and you've brought them back to life. I mean, to me, that's just beautiful, I have to say.
And here on Material Issues, David and I have discussed this before. We've had some guests on here that people go, wow, I didn't realize this person was in this band and they did this work. They might have had one album that was incredible. And we've brought them on this show, and it's like a new lease on life. And thank you so much for recognizing that we did this one album in 1971 and it flopped tremendously, but it's legendary in some circles.
And they
didn't want to be on the show because they just didn't, you know, they were getting older and things, but we said, it's important to tell your story and keep this archived, and you can show it to anybody you want that this was what happened.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful thing about it. And are you still actively collecting? Are you still actively searching for items that you don't even know exist yet?
Yeah. Yeah. That's exciting. Cause I have stuff. I have a want list. Things I've looked for 20 plus years. Once in a while I find like the 1962 7-Eleven show.
Oh, wow. That's by really trying. Yeah,
by really trying.
I heard a rumor about it in 1998. I always had it on my list. A few years ago, another friend of mine found one. Now I had a picture, finally landed a copy this year. So that does happen. And then there's the emails from out of the blue. Somebody often just saw Bathtubs Over Broadway and they work in a record store or
there it is. Yeah.
That's right. You found out about that. Yes. That was one of the great white elusive. My friend John Bowles, the punk rocker, had the only known copy of that. Yeah. He dubbed it for me. I mean, this is a great thing about collectors that this movie points out. Also, we want to share our finds with each other. We're not hoarders. We want to spread the wealth and excitedly get on the phone. Don Bowles, when he found Gould Growing in 1999 or whatever, called me up and said, you got to listen to this. And he put the phone near the stereo speakers and just played it for me over the phone. So, yeah, years later, a guy who watched Bathtubs Over Broadway wrote a message, I guess it was through Facebook, to the movie and said, love the movie so much. And also, it's so crazy that Gould record came up because I have a copy of that. And I saw this message and went, what? would you ever consider selling it or doing a trade? And this wonderful guy named Angel said, you don't have it now? You don't even
Have
it? And I said, no, you can't get that record. And he said, I'm going to just mail it to you. It belongs with you. It should be with you. That is the spirit of all these people that are part of the Bathtubs family that we feel so happy about. And I sent him a copy of the book and a batch of CDs of songs and all this. So I try to spread the wealth when I can, and people are very excited to be part of the story.
That's I have a similar story, although not as glorious as yours, but back in the day when I was young and had energy, I would go anywhere to buy records. And you know the song, I'm sure, Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes by Edison Lighthouse.
Can you sing a little bit?
Sing it, Dave.
Love because
love grows where my rosemary goes.
I don't know it. You know. Young, but it was a number one hit in 1970. I was an album collector, and I did not know if the band Edison Lighthouse had an album. And I kept asking record dealers, do they have an album? And some said yes, and some said no, but I could never find one. One time I was at a record show in Connecticut, and this one guy said, yes, there is one, and I have it. I don't have it with me, but I'll sell it to you. Now, he lived in Massachusetts. I lived in New York. I was ready to get in the car and drive 225 miles to buy this record. But then I thought a little bit, and I called him, and I said, what does the cover look like? And he said, oh, it's black and white with a flower pot on it. I said, oh, geez, is that the White Plains album? And he said, yeah, it is. And that's, they had the same, the, those two bands had the same lead singer, Tony Burrows. So I could see, I knew this was going to happen. And thank God I did that, because I didn't drive, I didn't have to drive all the way up there for nothing. But the postscript is, a bunch of years later, I found out that Edison Lighthouse did indeed have an album that was issued, for whatever reason, in Sweden only. They were a UK band. God knows why. It took me years, but I finally found a copy. And I mean, like 40 years after I asked the question, I finally had it. So I'm sure you've gone through similar stuff, but man, that was something in my life anyway.
I'm playing the long game on a lot of this stuff, where sometimes there's a guy I know has a stash of these, or like a Broadway original cast album collector and dealer. 1996, he loaned me a bunch of stuff that I could tape, but I had to give back. And subsequently, I found most of the records myself, found my own copies. But there was always one that I had never seen anywhere else. And I stayed in touch with the guy every year or two. We'd chat about this or that. And I'd say, oh, did you ever, I'm still interested in that GE album, air conditioner record. I don't know where any of those went. After you gave them back to me, I don't know where they went. So 1996, fast forward to early 2020. I hadn't talked to him in a while. He's getting older. I checked in with him. Hoped he's okay through the pandemic. No, he's fine. Still there. Chatting. Oh, I might know where those records are. Send me an email to remind me of what you're looking for. Sent him an email. Nothing. And then like 2 months later, he calls and I pick it up. Yeah, I found the records. So,
oh, wow.
So I went up to his place in Connecticut. And there finally was the stash of records I had taped and given back in 1996.
Wow.
26 years earlier. And now, I paid him a reasonable amount of money and sold the duplicates, as I do now sometimes, and kept the ones I needed.
What's your most elusive record that you know exists, but you haven't been able to get a hold of?
Oh, yeah. There is one. And you would think it would be common. It's a Ford introduction show. And usually the car shows, the dealer network was so large, you would press thousands of them to make sure everyone in the dealer network had one. This 1967 introduction show with music by Broadway composer Cy Coleman, exactly one copy has ever turned up. And it must have been like, they must have pressed like four dozen for like the VIP executives or something. And that's the only one anyone's ever seen. So if I live to 100, maybe I'll find my own. But I don't agonize about it now, because, I mean, if I find more records now, great. I like to. It's fun. But the big thing is the story has been told with Bathtubs. The legacy of my friends Hank and Pat and Sid and on, that is secure now. People will always understand this secret world. It's now been brought out into the sunlight. And as Hank told me when we did the soundtrack album for the movie, he said, back in the 70s in New York, the theater people there called me the king of industrial shows, and they meant it as an insult.
Wow, man.
Because that was the illegitimate stepchild of real theater in New York. If you did it well, it's great that you're making money, but you're not a real artist, obviously, if you're doing that hack job. But he said to me, now all those people are dead. I'm 94 and I get to.
All right.
People who were not born when any of this are happening are listening to Diesel Dazzle and listening to the Silicones record and going, this is unbelievable. This is great. And what vindication, unexpected, but it took a long time coming. But that makes me feel really good.
That's lovely.
The other question.
With that, go ahead, Mark. Do you have something?
we talk about the albums, but were there 45s?
Oh yeah, I got a lot of 7-inch records. Sometimes there's 45s with one or two songs on them. Sometimes it's a 7-inch 33 1/3 with.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a few 10-inch records, like the Edsel Dealer Show was on a 10-inch disc.
And speaking of the Edsel Dealer Show, here we go. This is the Edsel, an American original. This is the Edsel, a remarkable car. That's awesome.
Apparently, those salespeople weren't motivated enough. The Edsel went away quickly.
Yeah, the whole thing about August of 57, this musical show on stage, these people, these dealers and salesmen must have had stars in our eyes. Boy, did we just hit a home run signing up with Edsel. And it didn't take too many months for the sort of, oh, this isn't seeming to go that well. And I do enjoy the mental image of late 1959 when the whole thing was shut down. They canceled the 60 Edsel after 2 months. Imagine some dealer sitting in an office with the lights off, listening to that record and just drinking a whiskey out of the bottle.
By the way, to everyone who's listening, Bathtubs Over Broadway, which hopefully you're intrigued enough to watch, can be seen. There you go. Can be seen on Netflix right now. In fact, that's where I just rewatched it. That's why I know all the little details. But is it on anything else? Are there other streaming services?
I think you can get it on Amazon and iTunes, probably a few other things, that all the ones that you've kind of faintly heard of but aren't sure about, like Voodoo and I don't know what else. But,
Voodoo and all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, of course, if you're a record collector, you like musicals, and you just like the whole subculture of all this, you need to watch this documentary.
Right. Even if you love musicals. I take musicals very carefully on a case-by-case basis. I don't automatically love musicals. I love some. I love a lot of songs from some of them. But there's a huge subculture of people who just flinch at the idea of musicals. And I sympathize with that because I finally, when I was enjoying this stuff, I was saying, is it that because this is finally a musical about some weirdly technical masculine thing like diesel engines that I can relax and say, ah, now I found my musical. But you, even beyond any of the music, what Deva, the director, made with this movie, it surpassed what even I could have imagined would be the result, because it goes, you get the comedy elements of it and the kitsch, and then it just keeps going through the emotion. People staggered out of the movie would say to me, I expected to laugh. I didn't think I was going to be crying by the end.
Would you ever update the live show that you had done, showing the clips and things and bringing some of the people back? Would you ever?
Yeah, I would love that show again. I was kind of doing it intermittently. I kind of paused for a while because we didn't want people to think I was bringing the documentary to town. If I was bringing my own stage show where I show the entire GE Silicones film or the Purina Dog Chow film and kind of do my snarky but loving commentary about it, I also did live music. I would get up with a guitar and do a song from an Alan Sherman record that he did for Scott Paper Cups. I would do a live version of the Scott Paper Cup song, which is a very good song. Anyway, any version of that kind of ground to a halt with the pandemic, I would love to start up again in the early stages of planning some new live events. But if anyone out there is curious and wants to suggest a venue that sounds like a good match for a decidedly unusual but joyous evening of film and music, I love to get on a plane with a stack of records and a hard drive full of clips and blow into town and surprise everybody.
And what do you have going on right now, Steve? What's Steve Young working on right now?
Oh, it's a mishmash, which is kind of how I like it. I was at the same office every day for 25 years. I was an indoor cat. The last few years since Letterman ended, I've had a few shorter term TV gigs, but it's, I do some corporate gigs of my own now. Occasionally I get called in to do some branded content comedy or write stuff for a company's videos for their convention, which is kind of awesome. Like, I obviously have no snobbery about it. I think, yeah, I might actually really kind of enjoy diving into that. So I do that. You know, like everybody who's kind of a certain age and a certain creative bent, I'm working on a novel, second draft of it. So at least I kind of feel like maybe I'll end that someday. The big thing lately has been songwriting. And this kind of, you see wisps of this in Bathtubs Over Broadway, where I was playing guitar and singing a few times. And traveling around with the movie, I ended up in Nashville at one point. And I thought, Music City, I got to look into this. And then I read about how Nashville really works and how it takes years to crack into the inner circle of who's a trusted collaborator and how to get your songs heard. And I thought, forget it. But then I was down there and I just started meeting people from the music scene, and they said, oh, you're writing songs now? Oh, we'd love to hear them. Next thing you know, I've got a friend who is so excited. He wants to set up recording sessions and get my music made. So I've got really A-list musicians that have been coming together to help me get some songs done. And I was just in Nashville actually wearing this shirt.
There you go.
A video shoot, because you got to do music videos if you're going to put out music now. Okay. I don't know much about the music business, but I think I have picked up that fact. It's good to have videos.
Well, you're going to have to let us know so we can update everybody. And of course, scrolling across the screen right now, steveyoungworld.com. I'm sure that all information about what you have going on, you'll put on that website. So if people haven't seen Bathtubs Over Broadway, please check it out on Netflix or the other streaming services. What a fantastic documentary. And as you mentioned, Steve, or I told you, we're talking about this, everything's coming up, Prophets of Golden Age of Industrial Music, musicals, your book, that's been sold out for a long time, and it's selling for unbelievable amounts of money in some locations. But I hear you do have a few available if people want to contact you and get it direct.
Yes,
from...
reserve one for me before everyone who's listening types it in.
Right for you. But yeah, the sort of double-edged sword of Bathtubs Over Broadway was suddenly this movie was doing so beautifully, word of mouth. Everyone was watching the movie and then rushing to Amazon to order the book. And we sold out one printing. We did another printing. And then the publisher says, it's so tough now. The prices of everything have risen to print anything. And with the supply chain, we don't know if we would even get it in a year if we ordered it now.
So wow.
Luckily, the warehouse where all these were stored had dozens of copies that they said were hurt books, and they were damaged and unsaleable. And I said, I would like to see those for myself before we throw them away.
Yeah.
And shipped up to New York to the publisher. I went over. There were 93 books, 63 of them were pristine, still wrapped in the plastic.
Wow.
Another 30 had little nicks or bumps or minor issues. But I said, I'm not throwing away any of these. These are
right.
And people don't need to spend three figures on the secondary market. If people want one, I'll sell you one.
And real quick, Andy Hartley wants to know what the guitar is behind you.
Oh yes. That is an Epiphone Les Paul SL, which is a cheap Epiphone, but there's a guy in Florida who likes to scoop up low-end electric guitars and hot rod them. So this one has had better tuners, better pickups, better electronics. And I said, I'm going to send you a purple leopard print pick guard to put on it. So that's what he did.
Nice.
I love it.
It's an okay guitar. Probably most guitar people would not say that's an heirloom quality guitar, but it's just fun.
It's awesome.
Well, Steve, we're so pleased to have had you on this show. This is definitely going to rank as one of our favorite episodes. Seriously.
Well,
we had a great time with you.
Bathtubs continues to unfold because I continue to meet new people and have great conversations and make new friends. It's the gift that keeps on giving for me. And so I thank you for a wonderful chat, and it's a pleasure to meet both of you too.
Yes, our pleasure, Steve. Thank you again so much. Everybody, you can watch this live as you have, or you can see the archives here on Facebook or on YouTube, materialissues.com. Steve, best of luck with everything. Keep us updated on everything in the future. And what a fantastic job with the book, with this, you know, the industrial musicals, Babes on Bathtubs on Broadway, just over Broadway. Just, I'm excited to have had you here, and this has been wonderful.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And fair warning, when my music is ready to release, I'm sure I'm going to become a horrible pest and make sure you know about it.
We'll be waiting.
Yes, indeed.
Recognize the shirt.
Yes. Steve, have a wonderful evening. Stay safe, stay happy, stay healthy, and best wishes. Thanks again. Have a great night.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you both. My pleasure.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Well, David Bash. That was Steve.
That's up there. That one's definitely up there with our favorites.
That was an incredible interview. I was just a big fan from the moment I got that book. As you know, our friend Dana Countryman had done the magazine Cool and Strange Music magazine for all those issues, and never once talked about industrial. I don't even know if he knew about industrial musicals with all the
with all the record stores I've been in, you know, scouring all kinds of different genres. That is one I never knew about.
And absolutely fascinating. And of course, if you have not seen Bathtubs Over Broadway, which Steve Young stars in this documentary, so to speak, it's absolutely wonderful. You don't watch 10 minutes and go, it just holds your attention. And the stories behind the stories are what makes it even more special. And I dare anybody to get to the end and not feel, emotional.
You've got to, especially with him at the end, just tearing up over what he's done. I love that. So Netflix is probably the most easiest availability of it, but there are other channels, Amazon and a few others. So if you have a streaming service, check it out. Just put the title in your search engine, Bathtubs Over Broadway.
And if anybody has relatives that worked for the Ford Company in 1967, we're looking for that first that first record.
It's possible that they were just thrown away. It may be that they made more than we think, and somebody found them in a warehouse or in an office and said, "What's this crap?"
Yeah.
And that's how things become worth money. Yeah. It's not that only few were pressed, it's that they were destroyed. I mean, let's look at the 52 Topps cards, for example, in baseball. Those are the most valuable baseball cards around. And the reason being was after a few years, they had pallets of them at the Topps warehouse. And this was back in the late 50s when nobody thought baseball cards were worth anything. Cy Berger, the head of the company, said, "Get rid of them." And they dumped them in the East River. and that's the reason. It'd still be worth money now, no doubt about it. But they're worth, a set that I just talked to a dealer yesterday, a set that's graded a 2, all right, which, as you know, is one of the lowest grades out there, $100,000.
Yeah.
A set that's an 8 would be maybe $10 million. That's how pricey they are. But it's mainly because all these 52 Topps cards were dumped in the East River. So it's not always a case of few made. It's also many destroyed. So
and that's the beauty of people like Graham Alexander that bought Victor Records label. Victor Records over here in Camden, the home of the music business, they bulldozed 90% of the masters from 1900 to 1930, whatever it was, into the river. They said, we sold the company. Anybody want any? Some of the employees took a few. Everything else, masters that you can never replace.
It's absolutely nuts. I would slap silly anybody who did that. Even if there was no monetary value, the aesthetic value of these things is priceless, and nobody cared.
I know. I get it.
I'm just thinking about it right now.
Well, David, you and I are back together next weekend talking about miscellaneous things. Next Wednesday.
Yeah, we don't have a guest at the moment, but I know I've enjoyed the shows in which you and I just chat about whatever. And I really enjoyed last week's where we were playing stuff from the IPO CD. No. I'm not going to do that again, but it might be cool. You know, maybe we should have some segments where you and I play some just obscure records. Yeah. That people may not know. I mean, either obscure 45s from back in the day or, you know, tracks from pop albums of the past 30 years that people may not know about. I think those were, you know, shows like that every now and then would be fun.
But stay tuned, though. We have a lot of cool irons in the fire. People were just trying to solidify the dates. I know I told David, Jim McDermott from Simple Minds and playing now with Delamitri. He's going to be available one of the Wednesdays in August. We just have to nail it down because Delamitri is still touring around the UK right now. We've got three or four more really interesting people. We're just trying to get the dates right. So it's going to be cool. Stay tuned here on Facebook, Material Issues Group. Join the group and over on YouTube, materialissues.com. Every show that we've done is archived, so check it out. What a great show tonight, David. Thank you so much for...
thank you for getting Steve as a guest.
Yeah, fantastic. Really.
Glad to get to know him.
And we'll see everybody next Wednesday right here on Material Issues.
Absolutely. David. Have a great rest of your week. Stay safe. We hope to see you again next week.
Cheers.